numbers are. We know that it has been unprecedented. About myself returning, they also asked me the same question at Cannes. And I said, I will immediately return after the festival. And 24 hours after the end of the festival, I was in Tehran airport. Since I left Iran for the film campaign, of course, I heard that I have a new prison sentence, 1 year prison sentence and 2 years banned, and 2 years being banned from work. My trial happened in absentia, and my lawyer was supposed to give me the final results, but then the internet was shut down and the phones are shut down, and I have not heard from my lawyer. But as soon as the campaign ends, as I have said before, I will return to Iran in any possible way, under any circumstances, because it is there that I know I have to exist. It is there where I know I can make films and do what I like to do. Yes, I will return. I will definitely return.
The acclaimed Iranian filmmaker Jafar Panahi. Special thanks to Shaida Dayani. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Shea. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Portland.
New year, new KBOO. Thank you to everyone who contributed and supported us during our KBOO Fights Back End of Year campaign. With help from our community, we exceeded our $75,000 goal and will be able to continue bringing you grassroots, independent community radio.
Hello, I'm Scott King.
And I'm Joe Tursty. We host the KBOO podcast, the King Tursty Music Hour. Every month, we upload a new show to our KBOO website. We currently have over 80 shows available for you to listen and enjoy.
Each of our shows is based on a different theme. Enjoy great music as well as our discussion of the songs and artists. Our show is rock, soul, and blues based, but you might hear anything, including country, jazz, and classical.
The easiest way to find us is to simply enter King Tursty Music Hour into your web browser and select it with the KBOO FM extension. That's King, K-I-N-G, Tursty, T-U-R-S-I, Music Hour.
While you're there, check out our wide variety of shows. We've got shows on social issues, musical themes, people, the holidays, and so much more.
That's the King Tursty Music Hour on KBOO, Portland, Oregon.
morning. This is Jacqueline Keeler, and today's show, E Pluribus Unum, is we're going to be looking at ICE in Minneapolis and Portland and violence, Native detentions, tribal sovereignty, and what it means for all of us. Please do call in. This is a call-in show. The number is 503-231-8187. And I'm Jacqueline Keeler, your host here on KBOO. And we have the show every Thursday at 8 o'clock. And normally I'm a little late today, but I got a little too crazy with the audio clips this morning. So, but I think we do have a lot to discuss, even from last week. And as you know, we've been dealing with nationwide and really even internationally, Trump's escalation of violence and threats of violence abroad, and particularly in Minneapolis right now. The ICE operations there have been horrific. I'm sure you've all been watching the news and video clips and TikTok stuff and everything, and it's very devastating to see that, and it can happen to any of us. That's the main thing that we're being, that's the message that the Trump administration is sending right now. This can happen to anyone, and if you stand up or you're in the wrong place, you know, you could be subjected to this violence and trauma and everything that goes with it. So I think this would be a good time if, as a community, we could talk about this and what it means and how you're all feeling. Please do feel to call in to join this conversation here on KBOO. The number in the studio is 503-231-8187. So I want to also, you know, as I am a Native American journalist and you know, my father's tribe, the Yankton Sioux tribe, and has a lot of folks living in Minneapolis. It's probably the nearest large city. And historically, Minneapolis, as we discussed last week, was the site of the emergence of AIM, the American Indian Movement, where it basically formed as to protect the Native urban community there in Minneapolis, St. Paul, from the violence and depredations and harassment by the police there in the 60s and 70s. And so, it still continues to this day. As I mentioned last week, the AIM is still doing patrols, sadly enough, and certain Native urban communities like Little Earth have been ongoing for months now, have been subject to ICE harassment. And so, and sadly, we have more updates on that today as well. So stay with us, and we'll take your calls. We're ready for them, and we'll catch you up on what's happening, sadly. And so, once again, the number here is 503-231-8187, and this is your host, Jacqueline Keeler. So, as you know, the federal government has deployed thousands of ICE, Border Patrol, and DHS personnel in Minneapolis and conducting large-scale raids known as Operation Metro Surge. Yeah, that's happening. And as you also may know, the ICE agents have been given basically free rein to conduct these. And you know, with administration officials saying that there are no laws holding them back. They have no accountability. And of course, Stephen Miller making his statements about that. And we'll go a little bit more into the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division's refusal to investigate Renee Good's murder. So let's do a little clip here from an ICE agent, a recent interaction he had with a citizen of Minneapolis.
On Friday in St. Louis Park, a driver who claims to have stopped after seeing a crash between an ICE vehicle and a car in front of her also clashed with an agent. He asked her if she's learned anything, an apparent reference to Renee Good's killing.
Shame on you.
Listen, have y'all not learned from the past couple of days? Have you not learned?
Learned what? What's our lesson here? What do you want us to learn?
Following federal agents.
Give me my phone back.
Yeah, so that was a clip there of the interaction a woman had with an ICE agent in Minnesota, and she spoke to the WCCO radio in Minneapolis and said she had her head slammed into the hood of her car and was handcuffed on Friday, January 9th, 2 days after Good's killing. And so she's part of a community chat group that notifies people of ICE activity in the area. And we discussed this last week, too, how Trump is trying to make it, you know, really dangerous to even observe what ICE is doing. And just the, I know a lot of you are probably out there, you know, considering or are doing ICE observations. And I just thank you for your work. But I still hope that you all stay safe out there as well. So this was just a comment by an ICE agent just 2 days after the death of Renee Good, who was, as you know, murdered by an ICE agent. This woman did not provide her real name because of, you know, but she actually went to the St. Louis Park after she'd seen they were at the mall, local mall. And then she was assaulted herself. That's what we're hearing. There are some reports out that internal chatter's been leaked from ICE agents where they are actually afraid that they've really angered the population. But as you know, that is not necessarily going to be, it's not going to rein them in. So this has been just one of many violent encounters ICE has had here in Minneapolis and across the country. I don't mean to trigger anyone, but if we're going to, what has also come out is, Renee Good's last words to the ICE agent who murdered her. Let's go ahead and play that.
That's fine, dude. I'm not mad at you. Show your face.
Yeah. So that was actually released by the ICE agent himself. It was his own phone footage. And shows her being very, not at all threatening to him at all. I don't know why, it's just astounding. And we went over last week, DHS Secretary Noem's response, trying to paint her as a domestic terrorist, which she has not backed down from. Becca Good's wife, Renee Good's wife, Becca, her widow, said that Renee was a Christian who knew that all religions teach the same essential truth. We are here to love her, to love each other, care for each other, and keep each other safe and whole. Renee's sentiments were met with violence and brutality and hatred. And that's what we're seeing in our communities all over the country. The family is suing, and they will conduct an investigation of Good's death and be releasing the information in the coming weeks. And of course this comes at the same time where the U.S. Justice Department, the DOJ, is saying that they see no basis to open a federal civil rights investigation into the shooting. I understand the FBI is conducting a probe. And on top of this, almost a half, about six federal prosecutors in Minnesota resigned this week. More resigned also from the Civil Rights Division in Washington, D.C. I've been writing about this actually on my Substack. You can find me on Substack, Jacqueline Keeler, my newsletter there where I write about a lot of issues. For myself, the head of the U.S. Civil Rights Department, Civil Rights Division, the Department of Justice also attended the same college I did at the same time I was there at Dartmouth College. And I'm working on a three-part series on Substack about what it was like to grow up. I did kind of grow up. I was a teenager when I got to campus in Hanover, New Hampshire, up in the woods in the cold mountains there in New England, with a whole bunch of very privileged white people, white kids. And of course, Dartmouth is I think, and was, and I think still is, a very conservative Ivy League college, very remote. It was actually all male until like 1976. So it was, and so it has a lot of built-in privilege, a lot of, not a lot of, it's a very Greek, fraternity-oriented campus. I mean, the city of the town of Hanover is tiny, so there's not much else going on. And I was attracted to it. I was recruited to go there, and I actually chose it over Yale University because of the Native American program there. And Dartmouth was originally founded in the 1760s. It was granted a charter by King George III of England to educate Indian youth and others. But they focused for 200 years mostly on the others, and then they recommitted themselves in 1968 to educating Native students. And the head of the Civil Rights Division, Harmeet Dillon, she was a class of 89, and she was also a member of the an editor of the Dartmouth Review. And if you don't know the Dartmouth Review, they are sort of a college campus version of the National Review, which is a right-wing outlet. And they were pretty awful on campus. A number of people you may know were at that time editors of the Dartmouth Review. And that includes Laura Ingraham, who has her own show on TV, and also Dinesh D'Souza, who is a right-wing person who was actually pardoned by Trump for his fraudulent fundraising. And so these three are, you know, I think Harmeet Dillon actually went on Laura Ingraham's show, and they both were celebrating Trump's pardoning of their fellow Dartmouth Review alum. So it's just, you see the way in which the sort of which I think on campus, even at a conservative campus like Dartmouth, Dartmouth Review was regarded as just incredibly offensive. And they even had, when she was there at the Dartmouth Review, they even had an issue of their paper where they put the one of Dartmouth's first Jewish presidents, they put him on the cover and they made him look like Hitler, just because they felt like he was, you know, maybe too liberal, or, you know, holding, you know, constraining them in some way. And Harmeet Dillon is Indian American, Sikh, and of course Dinesh D'Souza, he is Indian American as well, with some Portuguese ancestry way back. And of course Laura Ingraham is a blonde white lady. And so it was coming to campus and experiencing that was a real shock to me. I was, not used to that kind of environment. And what we were freshman week at Dartmouth, the Native students, we were given a certain amount of preparation for what was to come, which we weren't given, I'd have to say, before this, which would have been good to know before making the choice I made to go there. But that there was this huge issue about the mascot. When Native students started coming in the 70s to Dartmouth, the first thing they did was organize to get rid of the Dartmouth Indian mascot. And they did so successfully, like in 1973 or 74. But of course, the alumni and the Dartmouth Review were really not liking this, and they constantly were trying to bring it back. And my freshman week, the Dartmouth Native alums, they kind of told us how what it was like when they got there, when they were there in the late 60s, early 70s, and what to expect, and what they did to try to change what we would have to endure. And so they prepared us for it. And freshman week is when just the freshmen are on campus before everyone else gets there, and they kind of prepare you for the year. And then and then one day outside my window of my dorm, I saw a truck coming by, and it was just a regular truck. In the back, they were a whole bunch of Dartmouth Review editors, and they were throwing out to my classmates free Dartmouth Indian T-shirts. And my roommate took one, you know, and she was a white woman from Massachusetts, not familiar with Native people at all. Myself and another Navajo woman, we were her neighbors next door. I mean, my roommate and then my, yeah. So then she, and we tried to talk to her. We tried to tell her why this was offensive because she was wearing it. And she was like, she just didn't understand. I was sort of shocked. Like, she couldn't understand the issue, why it was offensive to us and why it wasn't a great idea to be wearing it in front of us. And she was just like, well, it's just a free T-shirt, right? You know, she'd say at the Dartmouth Co-op, you know, where they sell a lot of Dartmouth stuff, like, it's so expensive to buy a T-shirt. And it was even then. I think even then it was like $29 to get a T-shirt, you know. And but, I mean, it was just ridiculous. Obviously, she was not a poor person. She was from a well-to-do background. And that she was using that as an excuse to wear something so offensive was, I think, was just it was a wake-up call for me. I was a kid. I didn't know much about the world, and I was sort of surprised. I just had no idea that people were like this. And it was terrifying, really, to see all my classmates just jumping up in the air and trying to grab these free Dartmouth Indian T-shirts. And so this is sort of the dynamic that I saw coming out of these people, like Harmeet Dhillon, who is now head of the Civil Rights Division, and who has basically ordered that there would be no investigation of Renee Good. And so my piece, I'm working on a three-part series, is looking at how do we get from here, from there, where these sort of outlier people pursuing these obnoxious agendas are now running things, you know, and are actually, you know, making it okay to murder citizens in the street. You know, we went from this to that. And of course, it took decades, but I think it's important to look at that. And for myself, I'm reexamining those early experiences with these far-right people At Dartmouth, these far-right people were the people who ended up in power, you know? And I was told when I was at Dartmouth, when I started running for the Dartmouth newspaper, the college paper, and it's like the oldest continuing published college paper in the country. And I was told, like, if I wrote for the Dartmouth Review, that my career would be made in Washington, D.C. Like, it was a straight route to power, you know? And so this connection between these sort of groups that were kind of seen as fringe, maybe even with conservatives, like Reagan-era conservatives, these people were seen as extremists, you know, that this is now what is actually, this is the force that we meet in the street. This is the force that is coming after us, that could attack us, hurt us, even kill us at any time. And so but that's why I had to do a three-part series, because I really had to kind of take it apart, you know, and really look at the different elements of it. And it's pretty chilling in a lot of ways. And you know, also, you know, I think I spoke a bit last week about, you know, sort of the South African component of the billionaires club, you know, the tech bros who are, you know, really in deep with Trump, you know, that you know, you have Elon Musk from South Africa, you know, his mother's family were staunch apartheid supporters, and you have Peter Thiel, you know, who is basically created J.D. Vance, right, as a political player, and you know, they you know, he lived in Namibia, which was a German colony. You look up the genocide they conducted there before the Holocaust in World War II, and his family were there because it was a place that still celebrated Hitler, and they celebrated Hitler's 100th birthday, like in 1989 or something, while he was still a young person. So it was, you know, it's a little German colony, and they still love the Third Reich. And so it's these are people coming from a, you know, an extreme position. And then Peter Thiel did found the Stanford Review at Stanford University when he was an undergraduate, which was inspired by the Dartmouth Review, which of course was inspired by the National Review, started by William F. Buckley Jr. And so, and then, so like, how the Dartmouth Review, before I got there, they had actually torn down a shanty town that had been built in the college green. It's sort of the central square of the campus, and they tore it down because the shanty town was there as part of the anti-apartheid movement that was going on campus, and so these people who were seen as really horrific. You know, even the New York Times was writing about the horrible things the Dartmouth Review was doing. You know, at the time it was notable that they were so extreme, but now these people are running things, and that is a pathway to tyranny that I think deserves to be looked at more closely. And so that's what I'm writing about in my Substack. But yes, I got a little off topic there, but that'll be coming out in my Substack shortly in the next few days. So I do want to hear from you. It's been pretty quiet out there. The number here is 503-231-8187. How do you feel about federal immigration enforcement and violence in Minneapolis? And also, what does it mean for Portland? Obviously, we are in his sights, Trump. And I believe that he is trying to bring up more federal agents into all blue states, and certainly Portland and Chicago and Los Angeles and Washington D.C. and Minneapolis have all been targeted. So what do you feel? Please do call in, and I'd love to hear what you have to say. And I do think it's important we do talk about these issues as a community. So the number here is 503-231-8187. This next half, I wanted to talk a bit about Native Americans who've been detained by ICE. This is not to overlook the hundreds of people who have been detained and traumatized by ICE in Minneapolis alone, but I thought I'd talk a bit about this. If you want to call in and bring up more cases that I have not discussing explicitly, I will. Please do add to the conversation. So, ICE has been detaining Native tribal citizens in Minneapolis, despite them being both U.S. citizens and tribal citizens. And so the Oglala Sioux Tribe president, Frank Starr's come out, has issued a whole press release discussing how this is a treaty violation. Four members of his own tribe have been held by ICE. He basically issued a statement saying this is a treaty violation. Treaties are not optional. Sovereignty is not conditional. Our citizens are not negotiable. And what he means by that last statement is that when he asked ICE for more information about the tribal citizens who were detained, the Oglala Sioux tribal citizens, he was told that they wouldn't give him anything more than their first names unless the tribe would sign an agreement to help ICE with enforcement in South Dakota and on the reservation. And so basically, ICE is making it where tribes have to collude with these illegal actions in order to get information about their own tribal citizens who are being held by ICE. And that is as disgusting as it sounds. And so, the Oglala tribe also emphasized that our tribal citizens are not aliens. They fall outside immigration jurisdiction. So it's completely illegal to be detaining anyone in this way, but certainly tribal citizens. And here's one local perspective by Mary Lagarde of the Minneapolis American Indian Center, who said, "I never thought that I'd have my tribal ID hanging around my neck, but I do. It's just important that they have proper identification on them and not to panic." So I have an interview with about the four tribal citizens who were held. Do you want to play that right now?
Continue to watch the fallout from 1 week ago today. It was 1 week ago today when Renee Good was killed by an ICE agent in Minneapolis, and we've seen a lot of the fallout since. And as these immigration enforcement operations continue to grow across the Twin Cities, it's affecting communities you might not think of right away. The Oglala Sioux tribe says four of its members were detained by federal officials back on January 8th, and one they say has been released. But tribe attorneys have been told that there are still three in custody at the ICE Detention Center at Fort Snelling. Joining me now is Ruth Buffalo, CEO of the Minnesota Indigenous Women's Resource Center. Thank you for joining us.
Yes, Dosha, hello, and Matsukidads, thank you for the invite.
I don't know how much you personally know, but I have to ask, just given kind of the news of these four men, what have you been told about what happened, you know, initially and then the arrest? What can you tell us?
We have received reports that a total of five Native men, you know, tribal citizens, tribal members and descendants have been wrongfully detained by ICE federal agents, four from the same tribe, which is the Oglala Sioux tribe, and one a descendant of Red Lake Nation. The Red Lake Nation descendant has been released and is with family and seeking care, but it does sound like it was a very traumatic experience. The other four individuals were unhoused, and Oglala Sioux tribe, I believe, is working to locate their four tribal members.
Can you explain a little bit for those who may not understand the treaty? You know, it's in place. What does it affirm for tribal communities?
Simply put, you know, Native Americans, American Indians, tribal communities, Native Americans are United States citizens. And so essentially, in terms of explaining a trust and treaty responsibility of the United States federal government, the United States federal government has a trust and treaty obligation and responsibility to American Indians and Alaska Native people. And these inherent rights include being able to exercise our sovereignty, which means that we are able to be citizens, dual citizens, with the United States and with our respective tribal nation. And so those trust and treaty obligations.
So have you had any conversations with others about why are Native Americans who are citizens of the United States being detained by federal officials?
I would say at least 55%, if not more, live off the reservations in urban areas. And really, it's unfortunate, but oftentimes, you know, it's just a matter of profiling, really. DHS has been directly terrorizing the communities here in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And unfortunately, it's been black and brown communities. So there has been a very high rate of racial profiling. And so simply for the color of your skin, or, you know, it's just ridiculous because it's being based off of how you look. And many of our tribal citizens, tribal members, our tribal IDs are being disregarded. People are being harassed in broad daylight at a stoplight, minding their own business. And recently we've witnessed unsheltered Native men being harassed by ICE federal agents who are just sitting on the street, you know? So it's very alarming and very unfortunate that this sort of aggressive harassment, terroristic treatment is taking place upon our most vulnerable individuals. There's over 155 tribal nation citizens that live in the Twin Cities metro area, and we want everybody to be safe and to know their rights, and please remain peaceful and prayerful as we prepare for things that are to come here.
What's happening within the tribal communities?
We know that Oglala Sioux Tribe has released a statement and sent letters directly to Department of Interior and to Christy Noem. We know that Christy Noem has had a very contentious relationship with tribal nations in South Dakota. And it's just unfortunate that there are four Native men, Oglala men, tribal members, who were wrongfully detained by ICE. And many believe that they were housed at Fort Snelling, which has some really historic bad trauma there as well.
Yeah, so that was Ruth Anna Buffalo, and she is a tribal, well, she used to actually be a state legislative in the state legislature in South Dakota, and I covered her then when she was running. She's an amazing, amazing woman. And but that was her giving a rundown of what's going on with the detention and holding illegal holding of tribal citizens in Minneapolis. And as she mentioned at the end there, that they are actually being held at Fort Snelling. And I think I've mentioned before the Dakota Sioux War before. And this was in that time period in 1862, 1863, when hundreds of Dakota people were held in a concentration camp at Fort Snelling, and many died. I mean, I think, it was a really terrible winter. And unfortunately, ICE is operating on a building named after Bishop Whipple, who was an Episcopal bishop there in Minnesota. And he was a white person who was an ally. He advocated for Dakota people to be treated as human beings. He was the one that talked Lincoln down from basically doing a mass hanging of 300 Dakota men to 38, you know. And you know, it's sad that this building that is named after someone who stood up for the things that we all would like to believe we would do at that time is the one, it's the building named after him that ICE is using to traumatize more people now. And and of course, it's a place where, you know, they are traumatizing and holding Native people once again in 2026. And I do have another audio, it's very short, of a Dakota woman who was grabbed, taken by ICE yesterday in Minneapolis.
What the fuck?
Yo, what's going on? Why is she arrested? For what?
What's the charge?
What is she arrested for?
What the charge?
Yo!
Get out of the road. What can you get out of the road?
What is she arrested for?
That's your one warning. Get out of the road. Get out of the road. Get out.
What is she arrested for?
Yeah, get out of the road.
What is she arrested for?
Wait, Pat, tell him where my dog is. Wait,
you've been warned.
Where's your dog? Where's your dog at?
Don't worry about it.
That's my friend.
Lynn?
Where's your dog at?
You need to move your vehicle. Whose vehicle is this?
You
need to move your car.
Where's your dog at?
The police are taking the dog to Pups and Maple Grove.
Where's she going?
Your car.
Pups and Maple Grove. Okay. Where's your dog at?
We're going to get the police to call a tow truck because you don't want to move your car. Whose vehicle is this?
Don't worry about it. What's your name? Badge number.
I don't need to give you that.
For what?
For what?
For fraud.
So yeah, so that was a audio from the taking of a Dakota woman, Sophie Watso, an artist, and she was detained by ICE on her own ancestral lands. She is from the Shakopee Dakota Nation there in Minnesota, and so she was taken yesterday by ICE on the road. And so and of course I mentioned earlier that the location where she's going to be detained is particularly heartrending. She's being taken, you know, she was taken on Dakota land, and it's believed to have been, she's going to be held at Fort Snelling, which of course is where, for Dakota people, is the location of the concentration camp where our people were held. And hundreds of my own Dakota relatives were held there in brutal conditions. And as I mentioned earlier, many lost their lives. And so this is just more of the cruelty of the settler colonial state on full display in Minneapolis. And this is in addition to detaining four men from the Ogallala Sioux tribe and a Red Lake descendant. I believe I saw the footage of him being detained. He was in a truck with his aunt, who was a Red Lake tribal member, Ojibwe. And they basically just dragged him out of the cab of his truck. And then when his aunt questioned why they were hurting her nephew, they punched her in the face. So these are violent, violent episodes. And of course, they're happening to hundreds of people in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And so, but yeah, please do call in. I know that this is a heavy subject. And if you have anything to add, I'd be really happy to hear your perspective. The number here is 503-231-8187. And so I think for the last bit of the show, I wanted to discuss more about the Department of Justice and what's going on there. There has been, you know, even within ICE, statements have been leaked that they are ashamed. One from the Time magazine published an article where they quoted an ICE agent saying, "We're embarrassed over the handling of the Minneapolis shooting and operational decisions." But of course, I don't think that's going to change what we're seeing on the ground. I think that the issue of I wanted to discuss a bit the Department of Justice decision not to investigate, and in fact, it has gone beyond that. They are basically going to announce they're going to investigate Renee Good's widow. Can we play that audio clip? I think. Let me see. It's weird. Getting it ready. But and this is in addition to Department of Justice attorneys resigning and what that means to our justice system. Oh, we have a caller. Okay. Hi, Tangent.
Hey. Jacqueline. I just noticed something, and I hope I don't have much time. I have to get off pretty soon. But the deal is this. What that, not gentleman. What that thug said was, "Have you not learned?"
I know.
Okay. His dad, I guarantee you, his dad told him that, said that to him when reprimanding him. And have you ever heard, is that perfectly clear? This is going to hurt me more than it's going to hurt you. I think some others could probably interject other quips they've heard that are just completely bogus, basically. I mean, there's no answer, right? You can't have, there's no answer. No, it's not perfectly clear. Wow. Bam, you know. Or okay, if it's gonna hurt me you more than what you let me spank you, I'll take the brunt of the.
I mean, it's what he's asking. What we've learned is submission, Jimmy, and that is
the what I'm gonna say is just because I gotta go, but just simply that the patriarchy hurts men too, boys, I guess I would say, who then turn into men, and then they either use it or try to avoid it, which I've been doing my life, you know, setting myself. There we go. Okay, that's my goal.
Thank you. Can we have
get rid of that. And I'm more happy with matriarchy. I always hung out in the kitchen with the uncles and my dad were watching football. You know, I was with my aunts and mom and grandma, whatever.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, thank you.
More interesting. The conversation was much more.
Yeah, definitely. Well, good to hear from you. And we have another caller. Sorry. Thank you so much. Hi, Beatty. You're on KBOO.
Thank you. I want to make sure that our listeners are aware that this has a long history, and around the world when it's done by the U.S. government to other people, and it's done in the past to indigenous and Chinese and Japanese and African and other folks, union workers, or people trying to unionize, it has a pattern, and it's going to get a whole lot worse unless we wake up and unite and do what we need to do. The history shows us it sometimes works. And one of the things we've been trying to warn people about for decades is how not only how police are brutalizing the indigenous who are the most targeted and are the most victimized, and more of them than any other group, and then African American and whoever's perceived as the latest immigrant at the time. But in the Pacific Northwest Family Circle is an organization composed of people whose loved ones were murdered by police in Oregon and Washington. And that's not, they have all these rules to set up for the police to do bad things. They can lie, but we can go to prison for life if we lie, et cetera. But they're never to take, they're never to shoot in a moving vehicle.
Yes, yeah.
They're never to pull someone out of a car or out of a window. They're not to be busting windows to get folks. Of course, any seizure or confession or anything that's got through torture
or force it not to be held up by law. All those things are being thrown out the window. And we've been warning people for years that they're doing this to whites. They're doing this to Republicans, to MAGA. They're doing this to liberals, to Democrats, to black, brown, mentally scared, you know, whatever the situation is. They've been able to do that and get away with it because so many folks who have the most power and ability to do something to change it either have a vested interest in it or they're in denial. Mm-hmm. And they think, oh, that won't happen to me. Those are criminals and they deserve it. And then it goes after them and there's no one there for them. Mm-hmm. The police have the same pattern. And the oldest police association in the United States is Portland Police. And I don't want to call it a union because they don't follow the standards of union. They're not in solidarity with workers. But that what they will do is they bring in their squad cars evidence to plant on a scene. Knives and guns or fake guns. And they have the same story. I feared for my life. Somehow that justifies them doing something.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of that sort of railroading, not only just with the police officers, but with by the President of the United States, by Secretary Noem and all the administration and of course the heads of major departments. Actually, I wanted to, not to cut you off, but thank you for calling in, but I want to play a bit from what's happening at the Department of Justice right now. So could you play the clip about the, from the lawyer?
Hey, everybody. I have some news that's going to make your blood boil. Instead of investigating Renee Good's killer, the Justice Department is now investigating her wife. I'm Liz Oyer, the former pardon attorney for the Department of Justice. Six federal prosecutors in Minnesota resigned today after senior DOJ officials ordered them to begin investigating Renee Good's widow, Becca. One of the officials who quit was Joseph Thompson, the top career official in the Minnesota U.S. Attorney's Office. He was actually leading Trump's big fraud probe in Minnesota. This is not normal. There is absolutely no legal basis for the Justice Department to investigate Becca Good. They are simply searching for anything that could support their made-up claim that Renee Good was a domestic terrorist who deserved to die.
Yeah. So that was a former Justice Department lawyer, Liz Oyer. You can find her at Lawyer Oyer on different social media streams. So, but she has really great shorts about what's going on legally and how to understand it. And so, but yeah, this is, as she mentioned, among these people who have stepped out is actually Joseph Thompson. He is the federal prosecutor who is pursuing the whole case about different programs that Trump that they were going after Minnesota for, and he stepped down. It's gotten that bad. I mean, this is someone who was working with Trump on major issues, and as she mentioned, this is not normal because they do not want to follow the department's demand to pursue charges against Renee Good's widow rather than investigating the ICE officer, and so there's been this mass departure. People are just jumping ship from the Department of Justice, and this includes senior investigators who would normally have a major role in investigating these civil rights abuses, and this has basically amounted to a vote of no confidence in how the DOJ is handling these cases and involving deadly force by a federal agent, and so. So this is, as I mentioned before, I'm going to be doing a longer dive into sort of the head of that department who is making these calls. So I think, do we still have another caller in line? Hi, James, you're on the line. Hi, sorry about that interruption there. You're on KBOO.
I think that's me. My name is Jinx.
Oh, Jay, sorry. Okay, yeah, we missed her. That's all right. Hi, so I apologize. So yeah, you're on KBOO.
Well, thank you, Jackie. I wanted to say that as a non-Native woman, I really appreciate your program and your perspective. It's so important. I just learned yesterday that Johns Hopkins University has just had $2 billion slashed from its Indian Health Center.
Oh, my God.
And a few months ago, Trump slashed, I'm not sure how much, but 90% of the fund.
Well, you just broke up there. Could you repeat that again? Sorry.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. A few months ago, Trump slashed 90% of the funds for Native colleges.
Oh, my God. Yes, I remember that. Yeah.
And I just wanted to ask you if you know anything about that efforts to get that reinstated. Because he's when he's pressured, he does that sometimes. He says, okay, you can have the money.
Yeah, I haven't heard any updates on that. They have been able to get a lot of other funding held, including Indian Health Service funding, which is really important on the reservations. And but I know I'll follow up and more on that. I did ping some folks I know at Haskell, which was an Indian school, which is now a college, and in Lawrenceville, Kansas. And some of my family members have went to school there as well. And but that is it really has gotten, like you said, 95% of its budget cut. They're not even sure if they're going to be. I'm not sure if they were able to restart next year. But they and then of course the American Indian the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, where it's a major institution where Native artists go and get trained and you know, become part of the art world. And that has been defunded as well, and many other programs on reservations. I mean, reservation tribal colleges were really begun to act as a bridge so Native youth don't have to leave the reservation to get an education, which was what was going on when my parents were growing up with the relocation program. And often when they leave, they don't come back, you know. And so having these tribal colleges was a major initiative starting in the 70s to keep Native youth and to create, you know, intellectual wealth on the reservation, and so that it can add to the community. And so almost every tribe has a tribal college, and most of their funding definitely comes from the federal government. And I've been, had a wonderful experience, doing book readings at these tribal colleges, and it's a very special place. And as someone who went to school in a place in, you know, like as I mentioned earlier, in New England with very privileged white kids, it's really amazing to be in a space where you are the norm, you know, and you don't have to explain yourself or do all those mental gymnastics. You can just focus on learning. And so that there's an incredible value to that, you know. And I'll do some more research. I probably should ping them again. I've just been so busy with other topics, but I'll
right. Yeah. Right. I know that Ogallala Lakota College on Pine Ridge has not had the funding it has been promised for years.
Yes.
So
it's
some colleges. This is nothing new.
No, it's definitely. Go ahead. Sorry.
I also wanted to ask you of this is just to eliminate Native people?
Trump's vindictiveness towards Native people has, I think a lot of people have traced it to the role that tribal casinos played in bankrupting him in the late 80s, early 90s. His Atlantic City casinos. And so he's held a real sort of grudge. You know, he's a person who holds grudges, right? And so he's weaponizing his position to attack Native people. And he did that in his first administration as well. Coming, like, one of his first executive orders was to undo the win in Standing Rock at Dakota with the Dakota Access Pipeline, and then to reduce the Bears Ears National Monument by 85%. And we were his targets from the get-go. So
the Native casinos did
did well, did better,
I think that he was just a bad businessman. I don't think the Fatka tribes had to do much about it, but he certainly blamed them. And so, he was way over leveraged and just, you know, that's a whole nother show. Do we have one more? So thank you so much for calling in. And I'll look into that and see what I can find out more. I definitely need to call those tribal leaders again. So, okay. Do we have another caller? Hi, John. You are on KBOO. Thank you for calling in. Hello? Did we lose him? Okay. All right. Well, we have a few minutes, or actually just a minute now. But so thank you for joining us. Go ahead. Yeah. Hi, John. You are on KBOO. I think he's gone. It's been, I'm going to take a longer look, more at the Department of Justice and the increased, insanity and violence going on in our leadership in this country and internationally. And you can follow that on my Substack, Jacqueline Keeler, and learn more. But I guess the show's pretty much over now. So thank you for joining us. And I hope that next week we can have a discussion about something other than Trump's violence against the world. But thank you for calling, and I appreciate all the callers. This is Jacqueline Keeler, and you've been listening to E Pluribus Unum on KBOO.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the